Ted Koppel is joining us now, and this should be a fascinating conversation. Ted was anchor and managing editor of ABC News from 1980 to 2005, hosting more than 6,000 programs, the longest-serving network news anchor in U.S. broadcast history. He spent over 2 years as a war correspondent in Vietnam. His final work as a combat correspondent was when he was embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division during the invasion of Iraq. He accompanied President Nixon to China in 1972, covered every presidential campaign from Barry Goldwater in 64 to Barack Obama in 2008. He has won every significant television award and is a commentator and nonfiction book critic at NPR. We're talking about his new book, which is an alarming story. It's something that people in government haven't thought about, and after reading the book, perhaps they are, or at least they should. Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath is the title of the book. And Ted Koppel, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, and thank you, Kathleen.
What is amazing is that you had all these high-level people you talked to in this letter that was written to an important subcommittee many years ago warning about this possibility, and little inklings that this could happen because there have been cyber attacks, and it's just not catching on. Maybe it is now because you wrote the book, huh?
You know something? I think you've got it a little bit backwards, Kathleen, only because I wrote the book in the wake of hearing President Obama in 2 State of the Union addresses make passing reference to the danger of a cyber attack on our infrastructure and specifically on the power grid. After I read a speech that then Defense Secretary Leon Panetta gave several years ago in which he warned about the danger of a cyber Pearl Harbor, Janet Napolitano in her farewell speech at the National Press Club in Washington. She was the Secretary of Homeland Security at the time, warning about the danger of a cyber attack. And I thought, how can it be that all these top officials in government are warning about it, and we're not really hearing any follow-up? There's
right.
Nothing in the press, and there is no indication that the federal government has any plan for what would happen in the wake of something like this. We're talking about the danger of a huge segment of the country being without electricity for weeks, maybe months at a time. So millions of people would be affected. So my reason for writing the book was precisely because senior officials were talking about this, but nobody was paying any attention.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to me they weren't, because you remind us early in the book that the U.S., in collaboration with Israel, mounted a hugely successful, you write, cyber attack on Iran's nuclear program in 2008. Iran retaliated but chose Saudi Arabia and Aramco for their retaliation, destroying 30,000 of its computers. You would have thought somebody would think, oh, we might suffer retaliation in some form. What could it be? And that a cyber attack on our electrical grid might be a possibility. Because we were already doing something, right?
That's exactly right. And what's fascinating about this, Kathleen, is just as we were the first, and so far the only nation in the world to use the atomic bomb over Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II, so too we were the first, as you say, together with the Israelis, to use a major cyber attack against another nation's infrastructure. So, you know, the problem is we've opened that particular Pandora's box, and there is not a day goes by, there is not an hour that goes by that there are not cyber attacks in this country against just about every company. The former head of the National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, likes to say there are only 2 kinds of companies in the United States: those that have been hacked and those that don't yet know it.
Mm. You do indicate, though, don't you, Ted, early in the book, that a cyber attack on the electrical grid would require quite a bit of intelligence, quite a bit of know-how as to how the whole system operates?
Yes, I don't want to leave anyone with the impression, and I'm glad you raised the point, it's not easy. It's very, very complicated. But I'm also told by top intelligence officials that the Chinese are already inside our grid, The Russians are inside our grid. The Iranians, if they're not already inside it, are very close to getting inside it. But it takes probably a couple of years to quite literally map the interior of something as complex as the grid and figuring out how to take down parts of it. And the problem with the cyber attack is it can be ongoing. It is not like a natural disaster. You know, our federal government has all kinds of plans to deal with the aftermath of a hurricane, to deal with the aftermath of tornadoes or floods or blizzards or even an earthquake. Mm-hmm. It has no plan to deal with the aftermath of a cyber attack on the grid.
And when you say that the Chinese are inside our grid, what does that mean exactly?
What it means is they have already planted cyber devices inside the grid, so that quite literally, with the pressing of a key on a laptop computer, they could activate what amounts to a sort of cyber bomb that could take out a significant portion, if not the entire grid. Now, in saying that, let me also say there is no doubt in my mind that the United States has done the same thing inside the Chinese grid.
I was about to ask that.
Inside the Russian grid, inside, we could do the same thing to the Iranians, the North Koreans. I suspect that any country that is or has the potential of becoming an adversary of the United States, that the NSA has already planted cyber devices in their infrastructure.
Would it be likely, and do you worry at all, about terrorist groups like ISIS?
Yes. It is likely, and I worry a great deal about it. There is sort of a sliding scale of probability on the one hand and capability on the other hand. When you talk about capability, the Russians and the Chinese are at the top of the scale. But because we have so many interlocking interests with them, it's unlikely that they would take down the grid. Taking down the grid would be an act of war. There's no ambiguity about that. There's a problem connected with that in that you might not know. Attribution, who did it, mm-hmm. is going to be the big question, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But as you go down the scale of capability, after the Russians and the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Syrians, they all have cyber capability. ISIS also has it. Not to the degree that the others do. I don't believe that they have the capability of taking out all or part of any one of our grids now. But they have a lot of money, and they have the capability of hiring people with the expertise, and the equipment that you need to do it is available on the open market. So the possibility that an outfit like ISIS could use cyber warfare to take down a significant portion of our infrastructure is, I would say, not an immediate one, but inevitably it's going to happen. Mm. And when you listen to the kind of nonsense we've been hearing on the campaign trail, about in effect, as Donald Trump has said, not allowing any Muslims into the country because of the danger that they might launch some kind of a terrorist attack. The terrorist attacks that any single person or even a small group of people could launch with guns or even explosives is negligible compared to the kind of attack and the kind of damage that would be done by a cyber attack. And to launch a cyber attack, you don't need to come anywhere near the United States. You can launch it from Sydney, Australia. You can launch it from Buenos Aires. You can launch it from the Ukraine, anywhere in the world.
And we'll talk about the aftermath of that, because it would be horrendous in this country. If you can't, though, Ted, figure out where it's coming from, are we sophisticated enough to figure out some kind of plan to keep that attack from happening? Is our technology such that that's even available to us?
There clearly are defensive measures that can be and that are being taken, but in the final analysis, you have to understand, the Internet was never designed to be defended. It
right.
was never designed to be protected. The Internet was designed, as one Army intelligence officer said to me, it was designed so that professors could exchange good ideas. And the thought that somebody someday would be able to use the Internet as a weapon never occurred to the people who designed it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to come up with a 100% security-proof defense system for something that was never designed to be defended in the first place.
Ted Koppel is our guest, and his book, We'll Welcome Phone Calls. We'd love to hear from you. We have yet to talk about the aftermath, which is pretty alarming. He also traveled around the country and found places where people have, and we've done this before, certainly. We did it when I was a kid and worried about an attack from the Soviet Union, so some people would stockpile water and stockpile food. We've prepared for a possibility. This would be massive. And there are some places that have made preparations. He spent several days in Salt Lake City, where the Mormon families have been instructed to prepare for a disaster, so they've done quite a bit. Are there things that he thinks all families should be doing? He would like to see this, of course, discussed on the campaign trail. Maybe somebody will bring it up at one of the many, 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 many debates that are taking place between now and September, or then again, maybe it won't be discussed. Is it a priority issue for the United States, do you think? How would you like for us to be prepared? Are you concerned that this is a possibility and that nobody seems to have a plan in place to keep this from happening? Ted Koppel, author of Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, and Surviving the Aftermath. He, of course, is a veteran of ABC News. He was the anchor and managing editor of Nightline, terrific show. It's still on the air, actually, but not with Ted, from 1980 to 2005. Here's our phone number for you to join on air, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We're also in our winter membership drive, and your support is the foundation of our budget. It's what makes Wisconsin Public Radio your place for terrific programs. Ted Koppel will be with us again in just a moment. First, Lisa Nalbandian is with me to encourage you to go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 right now to make your gift in support of these interesting programs.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Lisa.
Well, this hour, we have about 30 minutes left or so, and we're looking for 19 more pledges. And I think we can do it. So pledge right now. Your support helps keep this station really strong. Help pay for the Kathleen Dunn Show with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have a really good time, and we take our job pretty seriously. We love bringing you wonderful conversations, important conversations, Monday through Thursday from 1 until 3. You really don't get a show like this in, well, anywhere.
It's true.
Truth be told.
Right.
So pledge by pledge, you can keep this show on the air. Pledge by pledge, and you can give now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Remember, give today and become a sustainer. As a sustaining member, you'll give a monthly amount. It could be $10 a month, $15 a month, and it will automatically come out of your bank account or credit card. Your monthly gift will continue until you ask us to make a change.
It means we can depend on you the way you depend on us, day in, day out, year in and year out. Mm-hmm. And you're in control. You can change your giving at any time. It's a convenient way to give, and it's really very helpful to WPR. Become a sustainer at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You might think, well, you know, WPR, they operate largely with tax dollars, right? You're absolutely right. We get funding from the federal government and from the state. But listener contributions, your pledges, pledge by pledge, make up the single largest source of our budget.
Yeah, it's so important to remember. It's your support that's vital to keeping Wisconsin Public Radio on the air. And now that you know how important Your support is make a pledge. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You know, Kathleen, the one common factor, I'm sure there's a lot of common factors, but there's a big one I'm thinking of among all of our listeners is that they love to read.
Yes.
And you've probably gotten many, many, probably too many book recommendations from your WPR listening. Maybe it's a book on chapter a day or an interview with an author or something that you've heard on a news program that made you want to go out and get that book, learn more, do your own research.
Your WPR listening leads to a never-ending book list, and actually Daniel Golden is with us on Monday afternoon to add to that book list.
Perfect.
A great guest. Your donation right now makes that kind of endless enjoyment and discovery possible. Give at WPR.org, 888-202-2552 to keep all those recommendations going your way.
You know, I love talking to some of our longtime listeners because they started listening to WPR when WPR was in the schools. So maybe you started listening when you were 3 or 4 or 5 years old with School of the Air. Or maybe you started listening in the car with your parents. Maybe you found us on your own. Either way, you probably want to see WPR continue. It's an important part of Wisconsin.
If you've never given before, now is the time. It's never too late to make that first contribution and to give you an idea. How about $5 a month?
Mm-hmm.
WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
When you make your pledge, clearly you're saying, I want to support WPR with a financial contribution. But you're saying so much more, too. You're saying, I value this program. I want more of it. It makes me think. It makes me laugh. You fill in the blank with the way you feel when you hear this show. There's such powerful feelings, and you make a powerful statement when you support what you value and what you believe in. Join, renew, make an extra gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
18 more pledges we're looking for in about 30 minutes, Lisa. Help out now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And remember this pledge drive, ask for your WPR t-shirt, show your pride for radio that you love when you give $10 a month at WPR.org. Or 888-202-2552.
Thank you very much for all of your pledges. I decided, Rita says, that signing up for the sustaining membership will keep me honest.
Aww.
Good to be honest. I love WPR. It's my go-to for news, information, and entertainment. Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Rita. Pledge right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Thanks, Lisa. A whole lot of interest in Ted Koppel's book, Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. So we're going to go to your phone calls, and let me give you the number. Our lines are filled right now, but they won't always be. So to join the conversation with Ted, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And let's start our calls with Adam in Milwaukee. Hi, Adam.
Yes, hi. Me and a friend kind of sit around sometimes and think of, you know, goofy things, like how come nobody ever robs a bank on a snowmobile after a snowstorm? And another one was, how come nobody ever attacks the grid in a rural area by attaching a cable to the ground and launching a cable over the high-tension wire towers? Is there any protection against that?
You sit around and think of these things? Adam? Adam, think good thoughts.
You people in Wisconsin have too much time on your hands.
I guess so. I didn't know people were thinking those things, Ted. What do you think about that, Ted?
Well, I'm still trying to deal with robbing a bank on a, on a snowmobile.
Right.
Not a bad idea.
Oh, there have been. Wasn't there something? This is way in the recesses of my mind. Wasn't there some kind of attack in California?
You're exactly right. There was an attack south of about 50 miles south of San Francisco, and it was an AK-47 attack, and they took out some of the large power transformers. In order for electricity to make it to your home, it has to go from the place where it is generated, whether it's generated, you know, by a nuclear power station or a power station that's driven by natural gas or gas. In any event, you have to transform that. You have to step up the power so that it can go on those high power lines at maximum speed. And then when it reaches the target area, you need step-down transformers so that it can be delivered into your home or place of business. I think something like 17 of these large power transformers were shot out with AK-47s. And it did an enormous amount of damage. Now, they were able to reroute the traffic, and power was only left. But it took them, my recollection is it took them about 17 days before they were able to get the that particular power station back online again. The problem with these large power transformers, and there are believed to be, nobody knows the exact number, there are believed to be about 10,000 of them in the country, is that each of them is unique. They are custom-made, and they weigh anywhere from 400,000 to 600,000 pounds. They cost about $10 to $15 million apiece, and most of them, the vast majority of them, about 80% of them, are not made in the United States. So if you lose a large power transformer, the time it takes to get a replacement is usually about a year.
Ooh.
You can imagine if not just 17 of them were taken out, but if a whole lot of them were taken out, it can be, you know, I mean, the largest power companies, and this was a Pacific Gas and Electric company that was where they were taken out. That's one of the largest in the country, and they do have backup transformers. The smaller companies do not.
Mm-hmm.
And the average age of these transformers is 38 years.
Mm.
So, you know, it's been a while since anyone has tried to replace them. And in some instances, the rail lines on which the transformers were delivered no longer even exist.
Mm. All right, here's our public radio audience really thinking of solutions. You got to love them for this. Samantha sent this email, Ted. What would increased distributed generation, such as residential solar and wind, including battery storage, do to defend against an attack on the grid? What about community microgrids?
All of those are not only perfectly sensible, they're terrific ideas, they are being implemented, but, you know, having solar panels at your house, for example, are going to help the individual, they are not going to help the community as a whole. The microgrids are tremendously useful and tremendously helpful in large measure because they're not on the internet. By definition, a microgrid is established in a particular area, more often than not in rural areas. And with all of these solutions that we're talking about, I don't want to discourage the notion of these solutions, but it's going to take years to establish enough of these microgrids to really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sue in Madison. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I was signed up at the library, and there was a big backup for your book, but I finally did get it. And I was scanning the back of your book, and here's my question. There's a suggestion that from the current Secretary of Homeland Security that said we should keep a battery-powered radio. And my question is, rather than a battery-powered radio, how about a solar radio or one with a crank? That's my question.
I'm sure the Secretary of Homeland Security would agree with you, but my conversation with him got to be kind of testy because I had a different question. Regardless of whether it's crank-powered, solar-powered, battery-powered, what exactly is it that you're going to tell us on that radio in the aftermath of an attack like this? You know, my question is, if indeed there were some kind of a federal plan to deal with the aftermath of an attack that is going to leave millions of people without electricity over a period of weeks or months, shouldn't we be sharing that plan with people now, before something happens, so that they can go out and implement the kinds of programs that are being recommended? But my sad conclusion is there is no plan.
The people who seem to have it all together, in some sense, you went to Salt Lake City and spent several days with Mormons who, I guess I wasn't aware of this, Ted, are prepared for disasters. It's part of what the community does, prepare yourself?
It's part of the historical tradition. And, you know, I spent some time with one of the top historians of the Mormon Church while I was out there, who sort of brought me up to speed on the last 150 years of the church's existence. And in effect, they were, I won't spend too much time on it, but they were driven from New York and Pennsylvania to Ohio and Missouri and Illinois. And in Illinois, they had set up this huge community called Nauvoo that was the size at the time of Chicago. And they were driven out of Nauvoo. And Brigham Young, who took over the church from Joseph Smith, Joseph Smith was actually lynched because the people of Illinois were that concerned about the growth of the Mormon church in Nauvoo. Brigham Young took the people out to Salt Lake City. I think in stopping in Salt Lake, there was no city there, stopping at the Salt Lake in large measure because he seemed to feel that this is such a godforsaken place that people are going to leave us alone out here.
Hmm.
But given that history, Mormons have prepared for the worst of times at all times. And I don't want to suggest that the Mormon Church is specifically preparing for a cyber attack on the power grid. They're preparing for whatever bad things may happen. But each Mormon family is encouraged to have a 3 to 6 month supply of food and water. There is a tremendous networking system that is set up from the neighborhood up through the different hierarchies of the church. It's very, very impressive.
Mm-hmm. And we've done some of that before. I certainly remember when we thought there might be a nuclear attack when I was a kid, hiding under desks, and there was talk about what we should do to prepare. Certainly there must have been the same kind of angst. Maybe even more dramatic after the atomic bomb was dropped, wasn't there?
Indeed there was, Kathleen, and I think that's an excellent point, because it was only by going through the various iterations of preparing for the danger of a nuclear attack that I think we and the Soviets ultimately came to the conclusion that none of these measures would really work,
yes.
That none of them would do any good. That a nuclear attack would be so devastating that even if you were huddled in your bomb shelter, you wouldn't find anything worth living for when you came out of that bomb shelter. And it was that gradual evolution of thinking over a period of quite a few years that ultimately led to the creation of the theory, the strategy of mutual assured destruction. Mad.
Mm-hmm.
The notion being, you won't attack us, because even if you do, we have enough nuclear firepower left that we could launch a counterattack that would be equally, if not more, devastating. And that balance of terror has been what has kept the world more or less safe for the past 70 years. The problem with cyber warfare, and we started talking about it a few minutes ago, is the problem of attribution. How do you respond if you don't know for sure who launched the attack against you?
Mm-hmm.
And just to remind people, when Sony put out that goofy movie mocking the North Korean leadership, and then shortly thereafter, or actually even before the movie was released, there was a cyber attack on Sony Pictures that devastated their computer system.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the country knew it had to have been the North Koreans who did it. It took the FBI, nevertheless, more than 2 months to establish that beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Sue, thanks so much for your call. We have a line open if you want to join the conversation with Ted Koppel. Ted's book is Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. We go next to Paul in West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good afternoon. Ted, the doomsday scenario that really concerns me is whether it's a digital cyber attack or physical attacks on some of these major step-down transformers. If this happens in January across the northern states, you know, in 8 hours, none of the furnaces will work, drug stores won't work, gas pumps won't work at gas stations. You are all the plumbing will freeze up in every house across the whole northern sector of states. I mean, it will go back to the Stone Age. I mean, have you discussed that with them?
We haven't talked about how awful it would be, so let's do that, Ted.
Yeah, well, I think is it Paul?
Yes.
Yes, I think Paul is raising precisely some of the issues that we have to think about. It doesn't exactly throw us back into the Stone Age, but it does throw us back, I'd say, into the middle of the 19th century. We're not, for the most part, especially those of us who are city dwellers or suburban dwellers, we're not very well equipped to handle that kind of a situation, particularly if it lasts for an extended period of time. And the notion, I mean, if you want to get a sense of what the United States would look like if, let's say, 20 or 30 million people were without power for a few months, take a look at Europe today. Take a look at the situation with those couple of million refugees coming out of Syria and coming out of Libya, and how difficult it is to accommodate them even throughout all of Europe, and the political tensions that arise because of it. Now, you may think that because we are one nation made up of 50 states, that it would be a lot easier in this country, and that states that still had power would open their arms to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of refugees from the cities. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. I do know that in one rural state that is not too terribly far from Washington, D.C., the governor established a plan that would mobilize his state guard and the sheriff's departments and the state police, and they would greet people coming in from nearby cities and give them a bottle of water and a sandwich and a map and tell them where the next gas station was, and also tell them to keep moving because the state doesn't have the infrastructure to take care of them. I think in the final analysis, if something like this happens, only the U.S. military will be in a position to maintain some sense of security.
And do you have some sense, Ted, we would, of course, hope that would have never happened, but the amount of foods that are put away right now, the food that we would need, the water that we would need, the generators that we would need, so that massive numbers of us wouldn't die?
Totally inadequate.
Hmm.
There may be sufficient water, and when you talk about backup generators, I'm sure there are backup generators that would be able to, keep the power going, let's say, in our major hospitals and in key locations, but not enough to keep the population going. And as far as food goes, in New York State, I talked to the man who headed up the Department of Homeland Security for the state. And I said, how many, they call them MREs, meals ready to eat. The U.S. military uses them. They are very nourishing. They have a high caloric content, and one MRE can certainly take care of an adult for a day, maybe even a little more than a day. And he said, well, we've got about 23 or 25 million of them here in New York State. Sounds like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But even if New York City alone were to go down, and you needed food for the 8 million residents of New York City, and you've got 23, 24 million MREs, what are you looking at? A three-day supply? A four-day supply? And then you're out.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is the government does not store truly massive quantities of MREs because they have a shelf life of only 5 years. So the government doesn't want to expend huge funds stockpiling MREs. On the other hand, freeze-dried food lasts about 25 or 30 years. And one of my recommendations would be that the federal government begin the process. It's not something you can do overnight. There's no place that can sell you a 3-month supply of freeze-dried food for 10 or 20 million people today or tomorrow or next week or next month. It would probably take 2 or 3 years to accumulate that kind of a backlog. But if we don't start now, it'll never be done.
Thanks so much, Paul, for your call. Let's go to Penny in Greenlight. Hi, Penny.
Hi. On a somewhat lighter note, I was channel surfing the other night, and I caught, I don't ever watch Fox, but I saw your interview with Bill O'Reilly. And I just want to thank you for being a calm voice in this political season. I also saw Spotlight this week, and you seem to be a vanishing breed, like the people on at the Boston paper were, that are reporting quality journalism. What's our future for that?
Well, thank you, first of all, because Spotlight is an extraordinary film, and it really does highlight some great investigative journalism that was done under very tough circumstances and with a very, very delicate subject. The future of journalism, look, we've still got NPR. We've still got the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and a few and PBS. And I mean, there are still some extraordinary examples of great journalism in this country. There is also a declining value system in the larger, broader area of journalism. And one of the problems is that so much journalism now is reduced to the snippets that come out in tweets and texting. And I think we see that kind of journalism being reflected in the rise of Donald Trump in particular. I think Mr. Trump has mastered the art of appealing to people who operate in 25 syllables or so. You know, it's easy to appeal to the kind of journalism that responds only to, you know, lines like "you're an idiot" and "you're a liar." That's, you know, it's really not journalism. It's another form of entertainment, but one which will have very serious consequences.
It's actually rather dangerous. We were talking to Julian Zelizer the first hour. It's just hard to imagine, or maybe our minds don't want to go there, some of our minds, of what a presidency would look like that was operating on that kind of level, Ted. It's hard to imagine.
I don't think the presidency would operate on that kind of level. It can't. It's, you know, the presidency has a sort of chilling effect, I think, on the people who occupy that office, and that they realize that, you know, a simple blather isn't gonna hack it anymore. There are things you have to do. There are problems that actually need to be resolved, and I have to assume. You know, H.L. Mencken famously said many, many years ago, nobody ever went broke underestimating the stupidity of the American public. But on the other hand, Winston Churchill said, the Americans, you know, eventually the Americans always do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted every other possibility. And we're in the process of exhausting all the other possibilities right now.
Ted Koppel, thank you very much for being with us and for writing such a provocative and very interesting book. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was a pleasure.
Ted Koppel, the book is Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath, something very few people have thought about, and maybe we should start thinking about it. If this kind of conversation is important, well, our membership drive is also really important, 888-202-2552 for your support. Thank you.